Hello and welcome back to Diddy and Hawthorne in the In-Between. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to my podcast about the relevancy of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book, and let's begin. This is a new episode format for us. I'm calling this a digression, and I'm doing this for two reasons. First, it's to make the guest episodes more valuable. So if we do several months of podcasts with straight guests, every individual guest is not going to be as valuable as they would otherwise. Two, I want to interact with you more, and this is one of the ways which I'm planning on doing that for the future of the show. This episode is inspired by an article that I found on Thought Catalog called 31 of the Most Beautiful and Profound Passages in Literature You'll Want to Read Over and Over Again. It's by Cody Neelis, and it was published on June 25th, 2015, so if you want a little more background on why I'm doing this episode, you might want to check that article out. Now, before we get into the meat of this episode, I have a couple of notes for you, just so that I can recognize my own bias and not feel so bad about publishing this episode afterwards. So first, a note on variety. I tried to get a good variety of novels and types of books for y'all, but I am restricted to the types of books and prose that I really admire in this, so that's just kind of a disclaimer. There aren't really a lot of science fiction or fantasy books on this list. A second note, I am a fanatic for forewords and beginnings, and that's simply because I believe that the most profound statements and ideas are generally found in the beginning. So a good number of them are going to be foreword quotes or page one quotes, just because I tend to gravitate towards liking those so much. Our first novel is Mother Night. You might recognize the title because we did an episode on it last week. If you scroll back to episode two, you will definitely see that. And please listen to it if you are interested in Kurt Vonnegut at all. It's a kind of a fascinating comparison between two of his most famous war books and how he developed as a writer in a way that allowed him to articulate his ideas about war. This book is a fictional memoir written supposedly by Howard W. Campbell Jr., but actually by Kurt Vonnegut. This has one of the most fascinating forewords and introductions that I've ever read, and I would strongly suggest you check out last week's episode for a more thorough analysis of what lies in that section. The passage I'm going to read is at the very end when Howard W. Campbell Jr., the main character, gets a note, fictional note, from his blue fairy godmother, quote unquote, basically his Secret Service worker, CIA worker, Frank, explaining to him that he was going to vindicate him from jail and that he was going to break some rules in order to help Howard W. Campbell out so that he didn't get murdered by the justice system. Here we go. Dear Howard, the discipline of a lifetime now collapses like the faded walls of Jericho. Who is Joshua, and what is the tune his trumpets play? I wish I knew. The music that has worked such havoc against such old walls is not loud. It is faint, diffuse, and peculiar. Could it be the music of my conscience? That, I doubt. I have done no wrong to you. I think the music must be an old soldier's itch for just a little treason, and treason this letter is. I here violate direct and explicit orders that were given to me, in the best interests of the United States of America. I here give you my true name, and I identify myself as the man you knew as Frank Wirtanen. My name is Harold J. Sparrow. My rank at the time of recruitment from the United States Army was colonel. My serial number is 0-61134. I exist. I can be seen, heard, and touched almost any day in or around the only dwelling on Coggins Pond, 6 miles due west of Hinckleyville, Maine. I affirm and will affirm under oath that I recruited you as an American agent and that you, at personal sacrifices that proved total, became one of the most effective agents of the Second World War. If there must be a trial of Howard W. Campbell Jr. by the forces of self-righteous nationalism, let it be one hell of a contest. Yours truly, Frank. So I'm about to be a free man again, to wander where I please. I find the prospect nauseating. Wow. Now the last bit, the prospect nauseating part, was actually my senior quote. And I'm just going to mention, because I have a little pang of regret about this, please type your senior quotes when you turn them in. I hand wrote mine and there are so many typos and the quote is just destroyed. So I wanted to put it in here at the very beginning just to do it justice, because it really didn't have any justice in my yearbook. Now, Kurt Vonnegut was originally a short story writer. He published in magazines like Playboy, which were massively difficult to gain entry to at the time he was writing, which was in the 60s. He was a huge player in the postmodernist movement. He died recently in the early 2000s, I think 2009 or 2010, something around there. And other books by him include Slapstick, Sirens of Titan, Bluebeard, Armageddon in Retrospect, Palm Sunday. Those aren't necessarily his most famous books, but those are some of my other favorites. Our next book, number two, is Me Talk Pretty One Day by David Sedaris. Sedaris is kind of a modern Truman Capote in that I believe his work is super valuable, and his style kind of reminds me of Capote's in a weird way. And also, they're both such quirky, cool people. This is a book that is really special to me in particular because I really relate to his humor. It's dark, it's satiric, it's almost moral in a weird way. And he's kind of the only humorist that can get me going besides, I don't know, Woody Allen. He specializes in essays, and so Me Talk Pretty One Day is a collection of essays, like most of his books, or all of his books, I think. And the passage I'm going to read to you is from the Black Bay Books edition. It has a beautiful cover and back cover, and the passage is on page 170 from the short story with the book's namesake title. And David is currently in France, trying to learn French in a French class, and he is relating all of these little anecdotes that he experienced in the class. When called upon, I delivered an effortless list of things that I detest. Blood sausage, intestinal pâtés, brain pudding. I'd learned these words the hard way. Having given it some thought, I then declared my love for IBM typewriters, the French word for bruise, and my electric floor waxer. It was a short list, but I still managed to mispronounce IBM and assign the wrong gender to both the floor waxer and the typewriter. The teacher's reaction led me to believe that these mistakes were capital crimes in the country of France. "Were you always this blah blah?" she asked. "Even a blah knows what a typewriter is feminine." I absorbed as much of her abuse as I could understand, thinking but not saying that I find it ridiculous to assign the gender to an inanimate object incapable of disrobing and making an occasional fool of itself. Why refer to Lady Crackpipe or Good Sir Dishrag when these things could never live up to all that their sex implied? I just want to note how difficult that was for me to read without just cracking up with laughter. His writing goes on and on like this, and I just love it so much. Another one of my favorite stories from him is about his Fitbit and his obsessive goals to reach what the Fitbit wants him to reach in picking up trash where he lives in England. That story is from his new book, Calypso, published in 2018. Please give that a read if you are so inclined. Other books by him include Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls, Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim, Naked, and of course, Calypso. Our next book is, of course, The Great Gatsby. I'm not sure if this book needs any further introduction. The edition that I have is the Penguin Essentials Edition. It's a little pocketbook. It's really cute. And I'm going to read the first page for y'all. In my younger and more vulnerable years, my father gave me some advice that I've been turning over in my mind ever since. "Whenever you feel like criticizing anyone," he told me, "just remember that all people in this world haven't had the advantages that you've had." He didn't say any more, but we have always been unusually communicative in a reserved way, and I understood that he meant a great deal more than that. In consequence, I'm inclined to reserve all judgments, a habit that has opened up many curious natures to me, and it also made me the victim of not a few veteran bores. The abnormal mind is quick to detect and attach itself to this quality when it appears in a normal person, and so it came about that in college I was unjustly accused of being a politician, because I was privy to the secret griefs of wild, unknown men. Most of the confidences were unsought. Frequently, I feigned sleep, preoccupation, or a hostile levity when I realized by some unmistakable sign that an intimate revelation was quivering on the horizon. For the intimate revelations of young men, or at least the terms in which they express them, are usually plagiaristic and marred by obvious suppressions. Reserving judgments is a matter of infinite hope. I am still a little afraid of missing something if I forget that, as my father snobbishly suggested, and I snobbishly repeat. A sense of the fundamental decencies is parceled out unequally at birth. I'm not going to analyze this passage, even though I'm really, really itching to, because we have two upcoming episodes on this book, and I feel like if I did anything now, it would take away from the richness of those discussions. In truth, I've read more about Fitzgerald than I have by him, which is, I think, a common trope in the literary world. He was most famously a short story writer in the 20s, and he is really famous for his relationships, namely with Zelda Fitzgerald, his wife from the South, and Ernest Hemingway. He was also known to frequent the houses of Picasso, Dali, Ezra Pound, etc. So this was really a massive, massive literary movement that he happened to be a part of. The group that he was a part of was called The Lost Generation, and if you haven't really researched any of this stuff, I would really, really recommend diving into it. It's a very interesting world, and a world that can tell us a lot about the world we live in today. If you want to read books about Fitzgerald, I would recommend Z by Therese Ann Fowler and A Movable Feast by Ernest Hemingway. Other books of Fitzgerald's that he wrote include This Side of Paradise, Tender is the Night, The Beautiful and the Damned, etc. There is a beautiful set of gold foiling books designed as a Fitzgerald anniversary collection from Penguin Classics. They certainly have a place in my dream library, and I recommend looking at those just to see some really beautiful Art Deco book covers. So our next book is Joan Didion's The White Album. This is one of my favorite books of all time. Joan Didion was a premier writer in the 60s and 70s. She covered a lot of the social and political scenes in those time periods, and she's done everything from movie scripts to short stories to novels. There is also a gorgeous photo of her in this photography book. I saw it when I was in New York at the Taschen store, which is this kind of niche art photography bookstore. If anyone knows who the author of that book is, I would be really, really appreciative if you could just comment or send that to me somehow. I've been looking for that book everywhere. This quote is on the first page. It is from the FSG edition. And I think that this is one of the only covers for this book available, which is really interesting because most of her books and most of the books from that time period have really progressed with covers to kind of keep up with the Joneses or the times, so to speak. But this one has it, and I think it's perfect for the content of the book. So, page one, The White Album. We tell ourselves stories in order to live. The princess is caged in the consulate. The man with the candy will lead the children into the sea. The naked woman on the ledge outside the window on the 16th floor is a victim of acidity, or the naked woman's an exhibitionist, and it'd be interesting to know which. We tell ourselves that it makes some difference whether the naked woman is about to commit a mortal sin or is about to register a political protest or is about to be the Aristophanic view snatched back to the human condition by the fireman in priest clothing, just visible in the window behind her, the one smiling at the telephoto lens. We look for the sermon in the suicide, for the social or moral lesson in the murder of five. We interpret what we see, select the most workable of the multiple choices. We live entirely, especially if we are writers, by the imposition of a narrative line of disparate images, by the ideas with which we have learned to freeze the shifting phantasmagoria, which is our actual experience. Okay, first of all, I have such a hard time reading this passage because I feel like I need to give it its due. And one of the things that I've kind of been obsessed with lately is recitation. So every time I go out running, I do 3-ish miles a day, I will bring a series of lines with me. Just I memorize them quickly before I leave and I add them to my long list of recitations. So this passage is something that I have been reciting and committing to memory. Why is that, you might say? Because I think it's worth it, and I think it's a really valuable passage, and it says something about the art of writing in general. So other books by Joan Didion include The Year of Magical Thinking, Blue Nights, Play It As It Lays, and South and West, which was her latest novel. I believe it came out in 2017. Our next book is the infamous Anna Karenina. Here we go. It's on page 93, and this is the Penguin Classics Deluxe Edition. The study was slowly lit up by the candle that was brought. Familiar details emerged. The deer's antlers, shelves of books, the back of the stove with a vent that had long been in need of repair, his father's sofa, the big desk, an open book on the desk, a broken ashtray, a notebook with his handwriting. When he saw it all, he was overcome by a momentary doubt of the possibility of setting up that new life he had dreamed of on the way. All these traces of his life seemed to seize hold of him and say to him, "No, you won't escape us and be different. You'll be the same as you were, with doubts and eternal dissatisfaction with yourself, vain attempts to improve and failures, and an eternal expectation of the happiness that has eluded you and is not possible for you." But that was how his things talked, while another voice in his soul said that he must not submit to his past and that it was possible to do anything with oneself. And listening to this voice, he went to the corner where he had 2 36-pound dumbbells and began lifting them, trying to cheer himself up with the exercise. There was a creak of steps outside the door. He hastily set down the dumbbells. This is very early on in the book. It's the character Levin, one of the chief characters in this book, and he is kind of constantly in an existential crisis state, and this passage in particular plays on the tension that Tolstoy is able to create, and a tension that is unique to his writing. I don't think I've read anything else that has quite the amount of suspense and push and pull that his writing does, and that makes it really cool to read over an 800-page span, because you're not getting small doses of it, you're getting this huge wave of it. Anna Karenina is one of those books that people always say they want to read or they have on their shelf for years and years and never read, but I have read it. I believe it's incredibly valuable, and I think that the hardest thing to do is to start something that you want to do. So if you want to read a book like War and Peace or like Anna Karenina, start. Read the first chapter, and you'll be amazed at how fast you can start trekking through these kinds of things. So Tolstoy was a writer in the 19th century in Russia. He was a contemporary of Dostoevsky and known for War and Peace, What is Art, these really long, drawn-out, masterful books. And he was also known for some longer short stories, so 60, 70 pages, almost novella-esque short stories. But all of his stuff plays on the changing cultures and ideals of Russia at that time, as well as the emerging factors in social psychology. I've already mentioned these, but other books by him include War and Peace and What is Art? Ooh, the next book is really special. This is called Indignation by Philip Roth. I don't know if you guys have ever read it, but if you are near college age or even young adults or even kind of older people would really benefit from reading this because it really encapsulates what it's like to be young and what it's like to be going through these kind of transitions in one's life. The edition I have now is Vintage International, but the first time I read this, and this was a mistake on my end, I borrowed it from my English teacher. So the book that I actually read first and all the quotes that I would have saved from it are with him. So the quotes that I'm going to read for you today are from the website Goodreads, just under Indignation by Philip Roth. Sorry about that, guys. I will have read this book again by the time this episode comes out, but I didn't have time to read it before making this episode. Here we go, and these are all over the place. You be greater than your feelings. I don't demand this of you. Life does. Otherwise, you'll be washed away by feelings. You'll be washed out to sea and never seen again. Other people's weakness can destroy you just as much as their strength can. Weak people are not harmless. Their weakness can be their strength. It was not my job to just pluck the chickens, but to eviscerate them. I hated that part. Nauseating and disgusting, but it had to be done. That's what I learned from my father and what I loved learning from him, that you do what you have to do. Is that what eternity is for? To muck over a lifetime's minutiae? Who could have imagined that one would have forever to remember each moment of life down to its tiniest component? Philip Roth has such compelling, thought-provoking work. It's really dense, and it's something that you kind of have to tackle slowly and not all at once. He was a modernist, one of the last modernists. I mean, some people said that he was a postmodernist, but I really think that he came at the end of the modernist period. He actually died recently, I think in early 2018, and that was a very sad moment for the literary community. His other books include American Pastoral, The Plot Against America, The Human Stain, and Everyman. He has, I think, 30 novels, and he just kind of pumped them out, especially when he was a bit older. Our next book is the most obscure book on this list. It is called Innocence by Roald Dahl. You know Roald Dahl if you've read The Witches or Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, but he also did a lot of really, really nitty-gritty adult fiction and nonfiction. So this is actually mostly a nonfictional book. I'm not sure if it's a compilation or not. The title is Innocence, Tales of Youth and Guile. It is a Penguin Classics version. And there are several other editions. I think some others are like Madness, Vengeance, things like that. And our quote today comes from the first page again, called Boy. An autobiography is a book a person writes about his own life, and it is usually full of all sorts of boring details. This is not an autobiography. I would never write a history of myself. On the other hand, throughout my young days at school and just afterwards, a number of things happened to me that I have never forgotten. None of these things is important, but each of them made such a tremendous impression on me that I have never been able to get them out of my mind. Each of them, even after a lapse of 50 and sometimes 60 years, has remained seared on my memory. I didn't have to search for any of them. All I had to do was skim them off the top of my consciousness and write them down. Some are funny, some are painful, some are unpleasant. I suppose that is why I have always remembered them so vividly. All are true. I really love that visual that he skims these memories off of the tip of his consciousness. That's such a visceral description, I think, like skimming the steam off of some milk or something. And the whole book is sort of like this. It's rather frank, and he has such a deliberate and articulate way of saying things, especially about childhood and saying these things in retrospect. I really admire the way that he was able to do that. I got this copy of the book in a store bookshop called Foyles in London. It's right next to the London Eye. It was kind of a very unique experience at a bookstore. I really, really enjoy that bookstore. The atmosphere is one of my favorites. A bit more about Roald Dahl. He was a Norwegian writer that grew up in Britain, so most people think that he's British, but he pretty much summered and grew up in Norway. His father died at a very young age for him. He had multiple siblings, and his mother was a single mother for quite some time. So she moved them around a lot in order to give them the best education that they could have gotten. His mother is someone that he really admires, and I don't blame him. I admire her as well, and she plays a principal role in these books for adults. Also, in Innocence, as kind of a runner-up, there's a story about how he got into writing, and a famous author in America at that time asked him to draw up a page of facts about his experience in World War II. You may remember our comparison to Vonnegut from the last episode. But I digress. He wrote up this page of facts for this famous writer who I wish I could remember the name of. It might have been Herman Melville or someone along those lines. But the page of facts ended up being this incredible short story that the famous writer got published and said, basically, congratulations, you're a writer. And that is how he got started. I already mentioned some of the other books he's written, The Witches, The BFG, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and of course, books like Innocence. Our next book is Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. This is one of my favorite books of all time. I need to reread it, but I've been procrastinating because it is a very heavy read, and you kind of get immersed completely into this story, and it's not the best not the best plot line to get obsessed with in happy, careless summer. So I've been waiting for winter to read it again. It's on page 4. I have the Penguin Classics Deluxe Edition. Again, I think these are really the best editions for Russian classics. That's just my opinion. Quickly, I forgot to mention the translation of Anna Karenina. It is by Richard PVR and Larissa Voloronsky. Sorry if I butchered that. And this translation, I just realized it's not actually written on the book, but it's by Oliver Reddy. I got this version off of Amazon. I'm not sure if that's why the translator's name isn't on the cover. It's kind of disappointing. Okay, this is one of my favorite passages of all time. This book, this list, I mean, is not chronological. It's not in order of importance or of beauty, I guess, in this case. But this is probably number one or number two in terms of my favorite quotes from all time. He was so badly dressed that many a man, even one used to the life, would have been ashamed to be seen in such rags in the daytime. But then this wasn't the sort of district where people were easily shocked. The proximity of the Haymarket, the profusion of notorious establishments, and the local residents, mainly craftsmen and workers, all crammed into these streets and lanes in the middle of town, often furnished the scene with such colorful characters that it would have been strange to be shocked whoever you met. Anyway, the young man's soul had already stored up so much spite and scorn that, for all his sometimes childish touchiness, his rags were the last thing he was ashamed of in public. Running into certain acquaintances or former friends was a different matter. These were people he disliked meeting on principle. Yet when a drunk, who was being carried down the street, heaven knows why or where, in an enormous empty cart pulled by an enormous dray horse, suddenly shouted as he went by, "Oi, you in the German hat," and started yelling at the top of his voice and pointing at him, the young man stopped in his tracks and his hand leapt to his head. It was a top hat, a Zimmerman, but badly worn and rusty in color, riddled with holes and covered in stains, brimless and knocked hideously out of shape. It wasn't shame, though, that overcame him, but quite a different feeling, more like alarm. Oh my goodness, where to start? The first time I read this book was sophomore year at my high school. My English teacher was kind of obsessed with it, although he's not teaching it anymore, I guess, because of the epilogue, which is a totally different story. I do hope that we get to do an episode on Crime and Punishment. DM me if you want to do an episode with me on this. But this passage was singled out in particular in class. I remember it was one of the first days of school, and just the comment on the description. He was so badly dressed that even someone who was homeless and was used to being homeless would have been ashamed to see him in such rags. How profound is that? And then the description of the hat, a German hat from the famous hat maker Zimmermann's, excuse me. So holed up and torn up that it's not really a hat anymore, but this kind of symbol of disgrace that is on Raskolnikov's body, and he wears it almost as punishment for himself. At least that's what I think. He's already in a state of mental anguish and guilt, but he doesn't express that outwardly, except, in my opinion, from his clothing. Now, Dostoevsky, I said before, he was a contemporary of Tolstoy, big contributor in the Russian classicists movement. He was interested in Freudian psychology, so especially Crime and Punishment, his masterpiece, but in his other books to a certain extent as well, he talks about all these different Freudian ideas, including guilt and sacrifice and our palatial internal impulses. That's a really big factor, and the subconscious and what that means and how that drives us in day-to-day life. Other books by him that I've read and loved include Notes from Underground, The Idiot, and The Gambler. He also has a book called like Demons or something that's supposed to be really good. Again, most of these books are enormously long, you know, 500 to 800 pages at least. Notes from Underground is, I think, the only exception to this. It's an extended short story, so it's about 200-ish pages, and it's about this guy who is going insane, and he is writing a story to himself, almost like the fictional account that we encountered earlier from Vonnegut's Mother Night. Our next book is The Sound and the Fury. This definitely does need an introduction. So, William Faulkner was a regionalist writer. He wrote mostly about the South. I think there was another area that he wrote about, not sure, but Mississippi was his domain. He started out as a fairly mainstream, straightforward writer in the early 20th century, 1900s, and quickly became obsessed with this idea. He was a modernist writer, by the way. He quickly became obsessed with this stream of consciousness, very sporadic but still deliberate way of writing that has since been a trademark of him in particular. And oh my goodness, is this guy famous? I think that he contributed as much or more as Tolstoy did to literature. That's just my opinion. But you can take whole Faulkner seminars in college. And if you get the opportunity, I would highly, highly recommend that you get started reading some Faulkner. The Sound and the Fury is divided into four parts. Benji, Quentin, Jason, and Dilsey/Faulkner. Each part is revolutionary in its own way. The first part, Benji, he narrates from a perspective of someone that is developmentally disabled. So their disability prevents them from being able to speak and communicate properly to other people, but his rendition of this idea is super brilliant. It's very, very hard to dissect, but it's worth it. Quentin, the section I'm going to read from now, is a very disturbed individual. He is quote unquote normal. He's the oldest son of the family, so there are a lot of responsibilities and aspects that go along with that. And he is pushed to the brink of absolution, the brink of all human endeavor. And I'm trying to be kind of vague here so that I don't give away what happens. Jason is another sibling, and these are all siblings, by the way, of the Compson family in the South. Jason is another sibling. He's extremely angry. He's just as dysfunctional as the other brothers, and he has an unruly obsession with Caddy, who I don't have time to get into this. I hope we do an episode on this book as well. There's just so much into it. We could even do an episode per part, probably. The last section, narrated by Faulkner but centered on Dilsey Gibson, the housemaid, for lack of a better term. Dilsey is one of the most revered and respected people in this book, which is really interesting considering the time and the setting that this book was written in, but it's written in Faulkner's trademark high literary style. It's almost like a big sermon at the end of the book, which is really, really cool. So the beginning of Quentin's section, I have the third Norton Critical Edition. This is a great edition pulled together by some really brainy people up there. You might recognize the Norton Anthology of Poetry, which is another famous series that they publish. So it's on page 50, June 2nd, 1910, the very beginning. When the shadow of the sash appeared on the curtains, it was between 7 and 8 o'clock, and then I was in time again, hearing the watch. It was grandfather's, and when father gave it to me, he said, "I give you the mausoleum of all hope and desire. It's rather excruciatingly apt that you will use it to gain the reducto absurdum of all human experience, which can fit your individual needs no better than it fitted his or his father's. I give it to you not that you may remember time, but that you might forget it now and then for a moment and not spend all your breath trying to conquer it. Because no battle is ever won, he said. They are not even fought. The field only reveals to man his own folly and despair, and victory is an illusion of philosophers and fools. Oh, wow. That was... Reading it again and again, I think I've read this book 3 or 4 times, just gives me chills. I am so touched by Faulkner's writing for reasons unknown. Oops, that was kind of a Samuel Beckett quote. So Faulkner, other books by him include As I Lay Dying, Light in August, and Absalom, Absalom, the latter of which is the most difficult book that he ever wrote, the most difficult to dissect and understand, I mean. He also has a very famous short story called A Rose for Emily. It is a really wonderful short story, and not in content, but in how it's written. I think you guys will appreciate it. Our next book is Norwegian Wood by Haruki Murakami. Murakami, like Didion and like Sidaris, is one of my favorite living writers of all time. He has a new book coming out called Killing Commendatore. It's coming out in October, I believe. Very, very excited for that. So Norwegian Wood, I think, is his first famous breakout novel. And I fell in love with it. This is my favorite novel by him. I've read several of them. So here we go, page 276. This is a vintage international edition. I was overcome with a sense of my own defilement. Though I returned to Tokyo, I did nothing for days but shut myself up in my room. My memory remained fixed on the dead rather than the living. The rooms I had set aside in there for Naoko were shuttered, the furniture draped in white, the windowsills dusty. I spent the better part of each day in those rooms, and I thought about Kazuki. So you finally made Naoko yours, I heard myself telling him. Oh well, she was yours to begin with, now maybe she's where she belongs. But in this world, in this imperfect world of the living, I did the best I could for Naoko. I tried to establish a new life for the two of us, but forget it, Kazuki, I'm giving her to you. You're the one she chose, after all. In the woods as dark as the depths of her own part, she hanged herself. Once upon a time, you dragged a part of me into the world of the dead, and now Naoko has dragged another part of me into that world. Sometimes I feel like a caretaker of a museum, a huge, empty museum where no one ever comes, and I'm watching over it for no one but myself. The blurb on the cover of this edition of the book says, "Masterly." It's from the New York Times Book Review. I couldn't agree more. This book really changed my perspective, and I think that's because Murakami's writing speaks to the characteristic darkness of Japanese writing and Japanese fiction and their society and culture in general. A lot of his themes are themes like suicide and morbidity and guilt and trying to come out of all of these tumultuous times that humans experience. I am more of a fan of his short stories, if I'm honest, just because I think that his writing is more refreshing in shorter doses. But that isn't to say that I haven't enjoyed some of his other novels. He has a huge novel, like 12 or 1300 pages long, called 1Q84, that I finished earlier this year. It was a very interesting read, for sure. And I know that doesn't mean much contextually for y'all if you haven't read it, but the longer books for me aren't as enjoyable just because they drag on, and his writing has a very stagnant quality to it. So unlike Tolstoy or Dostoevsky, there isn't this, it's a different kind of depth, and one that I personally don't prefer. I'm just not partial to it. This isn't a criticism of his writing at all. I think it's brilliant, and I'm going to continue reading his novels. So, just a bit of my two cents. Some of his other books, 1Q84, The Elephant Vanishes, which is a collection of short stories. My favorite from that one is Sleep. That is another runner-up. Absolutely on Music, Kafka on the Shore, The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle. He has several books that are just masterpieces. I believe Wind-Up Bird Chronicle and Kafka on the Shore in particular, and then 1Q84 is also very famous. Alrighty, our last novel, number 11. Sorry, this is a weird list of 11. I couldn't help myself. Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. Again, another one of my favorite top list books, a book that I read every year. I just read it over and over again. At its heart, it's about colonialism. It was published in 1899, so that was a particularly relevant subject at that time. Conrad was a really interesting guy. He wrote in 3 to 4 languages, and I believe his native language was French. He grew up in Brussels, Belgium, and Heart of Darkness is originally written in English, but English was his second or third language. And so that is super significant to me because it says that he could differentiate and respect the differences between all of these languages that he had come to know so well. He spent several years of his life on a cargo ship, I believe, and this story is kind of remnants from his journals and his recounts of his time on that ship. It's about this character, Marlowe, who goes to the Congo really in search of Kurtz, but kind of ends up on this really philosophical journey about the ivory that they find on the coast and, of course, colonialism. I have the Barnes & Noble Classics edition. I love these editions, you guys. Frankenstein, Wuthering Heights, Jane Austen novels, all of those kinds of things. Great, great, great with Barnes & Noble. In particular, the footnotes are what I look for, especially in these little colloquialisms that we wouldn't understand today. Barnes & Noble's, or their editors rather, do a really great job of going through these books with a fine-tooth comb and putting in the things that we might not know. Our quote today is in the middle of page 116. This is the reason why I affirm that Kurtz was a remarkable man. He had something to say. He said it. Since I had peered over the edge myself, I understand better the meaning of this stare that could not see the flame of the candle, but was wide enough to embrace the whole universe, piercing enough to penetrate all the hearts that beat in the darkness. He had summed up, he had judged. The horror! He was a remarkable man. After all, this was the expression of some sort of belief. It had candor, it had conviction, it had a vibrating note of revolt in its whisper. It had the appalling face of a glimpsed truth. The strange commingling of desire and hate. And it is not my own extremity I remember best, a vision of grayness without form, filled with physical pain and the careless contempt for the effervescence of all things, even of this pain itself. No, it is his extremity that I seem to have lived through. True, he had made the last stride, that he had stepped over the edge, while I had been permitted to draw back my hesitating foot. And perhaps in this is the whole difference. Perhaps all the wisdom and all the truth and all the sincerity are just compressed into that inappreciable moment of time in which we step over the threshold of the invisible. Perhaps. I like to think my summing up would not have been a word of careless contempt. Better his cry, much better. It was an affirmation, a moral victory paid for by innumerable defeats, by abominable terrors, by abominable satisfactions. But it was a victory. That is why I've remained loyal to Kurtz to the last, and even beyond, when a long time after I heard once more, not his own voice, but the echo of his magnificent eloquence thrown to me from a soul as translucently pure as a cliff of crystal. As you can tell by that passage, Conrad was really known for his impressionistic style that developed after some time. I recently read The Secret Agent, which is another one of his lesser known books, I'd say, but the impressionistic style was definitely still in development at that point, which was interesting because I had this juxtaposition of his masterpiece, Heart of Darkness, and this little known novel that was still brilliant in so many ways. And even though this novel isn't the most compelling subject today, it is still so relevant. I mean, colonialism, are you kidding me? That still happens. I mean, think about the Rwandan genocide, and think about this stuff with Mexico, and think about all of the different conquests and disruptions in Africa that are still going on. This book was published at a time when The White Man's Burden by Rudyard Kipling was the lay of the land, and it is being revisited now at a time when satires of that kind of stuff are the lay of the land. So I just think that it's so relevant and so important for you guys to look at and try to dissect and analyze. Other books by Conrad include The Secret Agent, again, Lord Jim Nostromo, Under Western Eyes. All right, that is all I have for this episode. If you want a list of the publisher / editions and the years that these books came out, it should be in the description of this episode. Please let me know what you guys think about these kind of digressionary, informal episodes. I really hope that you found it educational or at the very least entertaining. If you enjoyed the digression and would like to hear more from me, consider checking out the last episode where I discussed Mother Night by Kurt Vonnegut with Jenny Peterson. Also, stay tuned for the next episode in 2 weeks' time. We'll have another special guest and a different setting, and we'll be chatting about The Great Gatsby by Fitzgerald. Still there? One more thing then. Remember that leaving a comment or review on iTunes, Acast, Spotify, or any other guilty pleasure podcast platform helps leverage the show so that other literature enthusiasts can find the community. In other words, it helps a ton. See you guys in 2 weeks. I wanted to mention a new project on DHNI that I'm super excited about. So only those of you who are staying to the very, very end of the podcast are going to know about it first. Starting in October, I'm going to be releasing weekly Friday episodes in addition to our normal scheduled episodes as part of a project that I am calling Horrifying Classics. Ta-ta for now!